Nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In.
You have always been a voice of reason through all of this.
Appreciate your time, what you're doing for America.
I give you advice, and it doesn't work at all.
You are definitely not inept by any means.
I like to hear women say that about me.
Whatever advice you're going to send my way, I am 100% taking it.
I can't tell you what to do. I will not tell you what to do.
Okay. Well, thanks.
That wasn't the answer I wanted.
Are you kidding me?
Great stuff, Dr. Ray. I'm glad I called.
I've scheduled my day around listening to your radio show.
You don't have to laugh so hard.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Keeping with my commitment to let the bumper music run as long as I can to buy some free time on the program here, I let the thing run all the way out. You ever notice you listen to some of these talk show hosts, they usually jump in the first 5 seconds of the song. I thought, why do they do that? You got a chance just to kind of sit there and take another bite of sandwich or sip your drink. Me, in that 8 seconds, I write another page and a half of my book. All right, a little bit of exaggeration. This is Look Back Friday. Take previous calls, not in their entirety, edited by the capable hands. Well, I don't know if it'd be hands, a capable computer mind of Andrew Kruchek, who takes care of them, puts a time frame on them so I know how long they go. I listen to them again, second time. There's always more you can say. Always. I mean, you could say a ton of things about every call, and this is not therapy. This is not diagnosis. If you'll notice that, I diligently avoid any kind of diagnosis or anything that even starts to waft towards therapy. You can educate, give a few ideas, talk about what your options might be, maybe the risks or the positive of any given option that you choose as a parent or in a relationship. Calls on Look Back Friday are chosen because there was a term used within the call. There was a direction that I thought would be helpful to go, but because the caller had a more urgent question, you had to focus on the question. I couldn't go off on a tangent, but I can go off on a tangent here. So there are several calls sitting up there in the Look Back queue that we will get to momentarily. Familiarity breeds contempt. You've heard that, haven't you? Seems kind of cynical, doesn't it? Familiarity breeds contempt. In other words, the more you get to know someone, the more you're going to dislike them. Obviously, that's not always true. There are people in our lives that our love, our affection, our warmth grows the more you get to know them. Those of you who have been in durable marriages, loving marriages, safe to say that after 25 years, the love you have for your spouse is much deeper than it was the day you got married, even though the day you got married you thought it was pretty deep. Much deeper now. Much more intense. Maybe the rush of the newness and the novelty and the early affection is worn off, but it's been replaced by something much, much more profound. But familiarity breeds contempt does have a truth to it. That is, it is easy to like someone that you know in a very shallow way. You see this everywhere. People extrapolate to what someone is like after 22 minutes of contact. See it all the time. I hear it on news shows or pundit shows where they say, yeah, you know, I met him at a conference. We talked for about 20 minutes. What a great guy. You have no idea if he was a great guy. You talked to him for 20 minutes. I had somebody call the show here once. Dr. Ray, you must be a wonderful father. Did I say thank you? No, I didn't. I said, well, I'd like to be, but you can't know that. Because all you know is what you hear on this radio show. You don't know to the degree that it translates to living. Anybody can talk a good game. But you see, familiarity breeds contempt means as you get to know someone, you see them more and more in different situations. You hear them say different things. Stuff comes out that you had no idea. In the initial phases of the relationship, it was, this is nice. This is a nice person. This is a very pleasant human being. This is someone I really want to get to know. And then you find, as you get to know them, you're not so sure you want to get to know them. Love is tested by familiarity. It is easy for me to have kind feelings towards someone I don't know very well. My wife made an observation like this once. She said, did you notice that there are some people who generally think that the good people in their lives are the people they don't know very well? Because as they get to know them, they're less tolerant of their humanness. As a Christian, familiarity, it may breed a deeper knowledge of the person, but it shouldn't breed a contempt, and it shouldn't even breed an intolerance. As I get to know you, there's a lot more stuff about you I don't like. I don't like the way you chew gum. I don't like your political opinions. I don't like the fact that you curse. There's just a lot about you I don't like, and I'm finding this out. But if, in fact, this is someone that is central to my life, a brother, a mom, an adult kid, a spouse, then there's a lot at stake here. At stake is the relationship. You know, the lady that lives three houses down the street, if she's a curmudgeon, big deal. I drive by her house. Every once in a while, she might come out and tell me to get off her lawn. But that's it. I don't have to deal with her. Not so my cousin, who is in the family and I grew up with and I spent a lot of young adult time with, and now I find she's heading off in a different direction, and I really don't like so much about her now. And then, okay, I cannot like those things, but at the same time, I am called as a Christian to be at least somewhat understanding and somewhat forgiving and somewhat tolerant of her. I don't have to tolerate what she does, but tolerant of her as a person. Familiarity breeds contempt. I don't know who said it. You can probably go to the internet and find out who said it. And if this were a call-in show, I'm sure somebody would be calling in and saying, here's who said it. I think it's one of those skeptic authors, you know, Oscar Wilde or somebody like that. But the deeper you get to know someone, the more you are tested in your ability to forgive. Your ability to overlook. Your father-in-law's a pretty good guy overall, but man, he's got some opinions and habits that just hard to take. Okay. Well, don't let that familiarity with him breed contempt toward him so that these particular eccentricities or these particular frustrations of his personality now dwarf everything else. Familiarity for a Christian maybe should breed forgiveness. Familiarity breeds forgiveness. But here's the irony to all that. Would other people who are familiar with you say, as I've gotten to know you, I've just really liked you more and more. As I've gotten to know you, as I've become more familiar with you and your ways and your talking and your thoughts, I just find there's just so much more admirable about you. You want to say that, don't you? But there will be those. I think there will be those, especially given differences in personality, that will say, I don't relate to you. As I've gotten to know you more, I really don't relate to you all that well. But as a Christian, you don't have to have contempt to somebody you don't relate to all that well. And if that person is central to your life, then you probably should figure out how that familiarity is not going to destroy the relationship. That's your mom we're talking about here.
Dr. A, my mom is so, so difficult.
All right. So you're very familiar with your mom. You've lived with her a long time. Matter of fact, probably all your life. However, what can you do about that familiarity? Can you overlook some of it? Can you let it slide? You have to be upset by it. Does it have to build into contempt? Familiarity breeds contempt is a shibboleth, a catchphrase that I think Christians should struggle hard not to live by. Dr. Ray.
You're invited to an incredible night of football under the lights. Father Gabriel Richard High School welcomes you to cheer on the Irish at this year's homecoming football game on September 19th. Kickoff is at 7:30 p.m. at EMU's Reinierson Stadium. Tickets are available at the gate. All St. Thomas and FGR alumni are invited to the Eagle Suite for a reception. For more information, visit fgrhs.org. That's fgrhs.org. Go Irish, your hometown Catholic high school team.
When I heard other business owners say they finally found someone in the credit card industry they can trust, I wondered how he could help me. So when Mark from Schisler CPC offered to show me where all the money goes for credit card processing with a free analysis of my business, I jumped on it. He reviewed how the industry works, where we could save, and offered a no-contract guarantee on savings and excellent customer service. I'm saving thousands of dollars a year. Schisler CPC. Trust in them.
More information available on the Ave Maria website under Sponsor Business Directory.
I don't think we've replaced our siding since we moved in 20 years ago. But I'm sure it's still fine, right?
We better call Mighty Dog Roofing of Ann Arbor.
Damaged siding can cause mold buildup and weaken your home structure. Protect your family by calling local Catholics Dan and Mary Flanagan at Mighty Dog Roofing for a free inspection of your siding, roof, or windows. Mighty Dog Roofing, 734-224-4916. That's 734-224-4916.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Appreciate the company. I hope you're not getting too familiar with me that you're becoming contemptible of me. Dr. A. Guarendi, program here, Dr. Zinn, variant of the program, Look Back Friday. So, let's just begin. Before I begin, I'd like to pre-begin. I don't know who is more suspicious of a child's experiencing ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Would it be teachers or parents? My guess would be it's teachers. The teachers see the kid in situations where attention, focused attention, is demanded, especially younger kids. You're in a classroom setting. Boys, you're sitting still for the most part, and you have to focus over periods of time. That would be the test, at least to bring out whatever it is about this particular child's makeup that makes it harder for him. Boys are diagnosed ADHD 3 or 4 to 1 to girls, which is, I think, significant in and of itself, and it definitely does need to be some heavy research on that. But the teachers will say, this is what I think is going on because this is what he's doing. This is what I'm seeing. And they'll say, over my career, I've seen 427 kids. So I feel pretty confident in suggesting that this kid needs, quote unquote, evaluated. So let's chase this a little further through Chelsea's call. What makes you think that your 9-year-old is exhibiting some symptoms of ADHD?
His third grade teacher mentioned it and suggested that we ask his pediatrician. And then the pediatrician sent us home with some forms. I don't remember what the official name of the forms were, but the teachers at school had to fill them out, and then us parents filled them out, and just exhibits. We haven't gotten him diagnosed or anything, but just he does exhibit some symptoms of it while he's at school. And the examples that the teachers give, even though we don't experience it at home, we believe them because they sound like things that he would do and it makes sense to us. But we're pretty fearful of like going down a medication route, and we really don't want to get him diagnosed. We don't feel a need to get him diagnosed if there's any way that we could just treat symptoms. But mostly my wanted to get your thoughts because I was trying to find some sort of like Catholic or Christian like good resource for us as a family to understand what are some things we can do as parents to maybe help it along.
Did the first grade teacher, the second grade teacher, the kindergarten teacher bring this up?
No. In fact, in second grade, the second grade teacher brought some things up about him, and we specifically asked her if she thought it was anything related to this, and she very adamantly said no. And I shared that with the third grade teacher, and the third grade teacher was very helpful, but just said, you know, it's not their job to diagnose. They just want to point out, and mostly she was reaching out to us because she's having a little bit of a hard time with him focusing in class.
And is he not completing his assignments? Is he not completing his assignments?
He is, but he needs constant direction. So if she gives an instruction in class, he is not paying attention at all. And so she has to say, what did I just say? And then he might not be able to repeat it at all because he is not paying attention to that standard lecture type format. And we at home, we feel like he's very hands-on. You know, if he were to go to some Montessori school or if he were homeschooled, he probably wouldn't have any issue at all. It's really just the structure of the class just does not fit with him. That's just our personal opinion as parents.
Chelsea, there are so many directions to go in with what you just described. You said multiple sentences that in and of themselves need to be addressed. Let me give you a couple of them. First of all, ADHD, and it doesn't sound like it's ADHD. It sounds like more like ADD or the kind that is a more or less a spacey inattentive as opposed to an impulsive, more behavior-oriented kind of problem. So, given that, it's typically, it is a developmental problem. It's apparent, if it's going to be significant, it's apparent early on. The fact that now in third grade is the first time somebody's bringing this up could have several explanations. One would be the third grade work is coming faster and is a little more difficult for him. So he's tuning it out. He's retreating. Could be. It's one. Another one is just because you have attention problems does not mean you have a significant enough attention problems to be properly diagnosed. This is part of the reason why ADD and ADHD, in my opinion, and even according to some research, is horrifically overdiagnosed. That is because now we're saying anytime somebody has impulsivity or anytime somebody's inattentive, well, that could indicate ADD, ADHD, well, it's got to be significant. Let's say your son is kind of spacey. All right. So how spacey? If you take 100 kids and you had a way to measure spacey, where would he fall? Well, he's probably down around the 20th percentile. Okay. Well, that's not ADD. I mean, he's just kind of spacey. Got to be down around the 5th percentile. So that's another problem. She sounds like also that she's just talking at him too much. She's bringing him back, bringing him back, bringing him back, bringing him back. And he's kind of ignoring her, really. I mean, so what? I'm not interested in this. I'm spacing out. I'm doing other things. That's a factor. If he's playing video games or those kinds of things really, really, really appeal to him, and he's getting, he doesn't have to get a heavy diet of it, but he's just getting some of it. That could be a factor, because compared to schoolwork, those things are just way more desirable, way. So if he doesn't get that level of stimulation, whatever falls short of that is disinteresting. It's just, that's not something I want to pay attention to. I made some notes while I was listening to that. The exact words that Chelsea said, that she said, he shows some symptoms of it, meaning ADD. Well, yeah, we all show some symptoms of inattentiveness. The question becomes, again, how significant? This is what I saw a survey once. It was very disturbing. In some contexts, up to 30% of boys, elementary boys, got an ADD or ADHD diagnosis. 30%! What? What is happening is there's a lot of confusion around this. There is, I remember one time I got virulently chastised by a guy. I had attended several day long conference. And I thought that they did not focus enough on what is happening in the typical child's environment. In other words, especially boys, video games, computer games, all kinds of stuff. They're very fast paced. They're very entertaining. Oh man, they move. They're like video cocaine. And I thought this is a factor in kids, especially boys, having a harder time sustaining attention. Oh man, this guy called me up and he reamed me. How dare you say that? This is a neurologically, developmentally based problem. Well, since then, this was probably about 30 years ago. Yeah, I was the only eighth grader in the symposium. Research coming out says, yeah, these are factors. These are definitely factors in shortening our people's attention span, adults included. Everybody knows that. Research coming out all over the place. So you got to explore. I didn't have time to talk to Chelsea about this. I just threw it out as an option. But how much of this stuff is he getting at home? That's one. Secondly, the teacher's reminding him. When I used to consult with the schools, I said, okay, let's try this. No more reminding. At the end of the time that the subject is to be done. It's taken. It goes home. All of it goes home. And he finishes it on his own time at home. One thing I did, and some parents like this idea, I said, I'll tell you what you do. You keep, if you can get them, you keep some books similar or exactly like the subjects. And the stuff that comes home, he not only does what he needs to complete, that he didn't do at school, you add some. Let's see what happens. And for some kids, that was very successful in getting them to do the work at school. Is it an attention problem or is it I don't want to do it problem? Okay, so that's another thing. Now, here's something that's kind of, break's coming. All right, let me put it to this way. Here's something that is statistically a bit esoteric, abstruse would be the word, hard to understand because it's kind of hidden. I want to talk about it on the other side of the break, and this is regarding measuring ADHD. Now, you know the problem with all this classical music? It doesn't have any words. How can you sing it? You know, when I'm in the shower, how can I sing that song? My wife would be grateful and can't sing it. That's why she keeps saying, Ray, let's just get you some classical music to listen to, not the mamas and the papas. All righty, I want to continue with a little bit with Chelsea's call. Here was the point I wanted to make. At the beginning of the call, she said this. The teacher suspected there could be some attention problems, so talk to your pediatrician. All right. This is not to impugn pediatricians and general practitioners. They very commonly make this diagnosis. They really shouldn't. Not because they can't, but because they simply don't have the time. To properly make an ADD or ADHD diagnosis, you really got to observe the kid in class. You got to do a nice long interview with the parents, perhaps maybe with the child, to find out. You got to rule out other stuff. You got to find out what's going on in the history. You know, if this is a chaotic home existence and this kid is starting to show all kinds of temperament or attention problems or impulse problems, well, if you don't know there's a crazy marital situation, then you're going to mistakenly diagnose him like it's something wrong with him. Now, well, people will say to me in my office, can you diagnose ADHD? I'll say, I'd rather not, because I don't have the time to go to the classroom. I can talk to you, try to get a good history maybe, and that might put me on a better track. But here's another problem. Now, this is the, as I said, abstruse, recondite. That's a good word, recondite. You know, why do I use these words? Because I belong to this thing that I get in the email called Word Genius, and they send you these words. And they give you four choices on what the words mean. And by repetition, you begin to learn these words. Obviously, these words you don't use in daily conversation. I never say to my wife, well, you know, that's kind of a recondite argument. It wouldn't get me very far. Typically, what happened to Chelsea is what happens. The doctor gives the parents and the teachers some forms to fill out. There's all kinds of rating forms regarding attention, impulse control, etc. And you fill them out. And you rate the child, usually on a scale of 1 to 5, but could be various. You rate it. And then you score it. And you see, according to norms of that particular rating scale, where does the child fall? Lo and behold, teacher ratings, parent ratings, he comes back to 93rd percentile. That means according to what the parents or teachers rated, how significant these various aspects of his behavior and attention were, he is more distractible or more inattentive or more impulsive than 93% of kids his age. Now here's two complications. One, it is not his age. It is his mental age. So if you have somebody who's developmentally delayed, they're 10 years old, but in fact they're functioning about like an 8-year-old. And they seem to have attention problems. So when you measure it, you don't measure it according to 10-year-olds, you measure it according to 8-year-olds. That's the first thing. But here's the second thing that's even more subtle. In statistics, there is something called regression to the mean. Essentially, that means that when you repeat a test or a survey or some kind of rating scale a second time or a third, the score tends to become more normal. It regresses to the mean or the average score. So typically, these forms are given out one time. And what is then reported is used to make the diagnosis. What would happen if they were given out a second time? Would he still be in the 93rd percentile, or would he now be in the 82nd percentile? And if he's in the 82nd percentile, then he isn't really appropriate for an ADHD diagnosis. He may have more attention problems than kids his age. But we really, again, don't know why. We always assume that it's developmental or neurological. May not be. Who knows? Is there an anxiety disorder? Is this a kid who's not getting enough sleep? Is this a kid who spends 4 hours a day on his device? What is going on here? What is happening? Is this a kid who, by comparison, schoolwork is the most boring, the most dull, the most drag in his life? Let me draw an imperfect parallel. Of course, an imperfect parallel wouldn't be a parallel. Look around you at church, at Mass. Well, you shouldn't look around you, but just envision it. And you see the 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. What is their involvement in the Mass? Do they respond to the prayers? Oh, they might say the Our Father, because that's kind of something everybody does. But do they respond in the prayers? Do they sing? Or do they kind of stand there just sort of staring? Why is that? What is it? Of course, likely they don't really understand what the Mass is all about. They don't have any sense of their being in the presence of God. But I think there's another component, and that is, this is boring. This is routine. This is the same old, same old, same old every week. And so they stand there like pillars of salt. Their attention is not there. Is there a tie to the rest of their lives and Mass? In some respects, I believe this is why the independent evangelicals are siphoning off our families at such rates, because they are more entertaining. Their services are a higher energy level. Catholic services are beautiful, and they are absolutely, absolutely meant to connect us to God in a deep and profound way. However, in America, so many of us move, move, go, go, get, fast, fast. And so as a result, 15-year-old goes to Mass and he just kind of stares his way through the hour and he leaves. Indeed. I think what's happening is there's been a wholesale shortening of attention. And it's happening. And more kids are having a harder and harder time staying focused on the stuff that requires attention and sustained focus. And then we diagnose them too prematurely. Thank you so much for joining me here on The Doctor Is In, the variant e-person. I'm sorry, I'm getting my days confused. Look Back Friday. Let's take another call. This is an interesting one. I've oftentimes on this program said that I sometimes feel like I have an in-body experience. That is, I'm inside my body looking out through my eyes. Weird. But in fact, there is a phenomenon called an out-of-body experience. Out-of-body experiences particularly are interesting, and Father Robert Spitzer talks a lot about this in his books regarding the evidence for a soul on near-death experiences, where people actually experience they're out of their body. They're floating above it. They see things they shouldn't know when they come back and report it. Well, out-of-body experiences can also happen when you're fully awake or conscious. They're an odd kind of state, and it's hard to explain exactly what's going on cognitively, consciously. Mike has an interesting recollection. He said he had an out-of-body experience when he was 3.
Yeah, I was actually cleaning my kitchen when your dialogue was going on, and it makes me think of some experiences I had when I was a young child. Because what happened is, now I'm a very, you know, practicing Catholic, pretty faithful to the Catholic Church, I mean, as much as I can be. But growing up in this house, at 3 years old, I was awakened in the middle of a night, and there seemed to be some kind of a presence there. There was an out-of-the-body experience I had because that presence was able to draw me out and was kind of walking me through the room in order to show me something. The whole experience was, for a 3-year-old, for me, was kind of frightening because the person appeared to be a young person from a different time and was dressed as a monk. And I've never known exactly what to make of that experience as a Catholic.
How are you convinced, Mike, that it was absolutely real?
You know, I've had people ask me that because when you're asleep at night, sometimes, you know, and especially at that age, you might have like a dream or something like that. The reason I'm convinced that it was more real than imaginary is because about 2 or 3 years later, I was taking a break from a cartoon, and I ran down the hall to go use the restroom, and I peered inside a room, and I could see the same person standing there, looking straight back at me, for about a second or so, and it was the same person.
Was it the same person, or was it somehow a little 3-year-old's imagination?
Yeah. That's a good question. The second time that I saw what appeared to be this young man was 2 years later. And, just from my memory, when I saw it, it appeared to be the same thing that I had had.
We have a natural tendency to be attracted to the odd, the esoteric. The things that are outside of the norm of everyday existence. We do. Anytime you have something that is perplexing, like Mike's talking about, the first place you look is for a natural explanation. Many people are quick to see direct action by Satan in a circumstance or upon a person. And the church is very cautious this way. The church says, no, you've got to rule out every other possible explanation, including mental illness. Mike was 3, according to his own recount. A simple law of memory. The younger you are, the more unreliable that memory is. Did it happen? Or over the years, has it shifted? There's something called memory shifting. And psychologists who study this stuff will tell you it's a very common thing. You think you remember exactly what happened, as though it was imprinted on your mind. When in fact, if there is any way to get corroboration to see if historically that's what happened, in a lot of cases you find out it wasn't. One of the more fascinating studies I came across, I was taking a continuing education course in memory. I think that's what it was. Don't recall. The guy said that there was a prof who, this I believe the event, see there's my memory, but the principle is the same, whether the details are not quite right. It was after the shuttle disaster. This was back. When was the shuttle disaster? 87? I mean, it was back there. And he asked the students the next day, I believe, please write down exactly what you were doing when you first heard or saw the shuttle disaster. Everybody wrote it down. He collected them, kept them. I don't recall if it was 5 years or 10 years later. I don't think it's totally relevant. He recontacted the students that he had access to in some way. I'm sure he designed this as part of the experiment, so he probably got contact information. Of those that responded, he asked, "Where were you when you first saw or heard of the shuttle disaster?" And they were to write it down. His second question was, "How certain were you, are you, that that's where you were?" Oh, something like the shuttle disaster? Come on, that's impactful. They wrote down where they were, and they were absolutely certain where they were. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was at least 50% who wrote down on follow-up several years later where they were, and it was a completely different context from where they wrote the day after. How does this happen? We think our memories are just locked in, they're indelible, they don't move, but they shift. And I think it's partly, some theorists will say, because you remember the memory. The more I think about the memory, the more I'm like painting over it another coat of paint, and it shifts, it changes. I've had memories like that. I've been absolutely convinced of an episode that happened when my wife will say, "Ray, that's not where we were. And that's not when it happened." Now, how do we know who's right, her or me? Well, she's right because she's my wife, and whether she's right or not, she's going to be right from my perspective. But in fact, she had evidence. I didn't. Mine was just my memory. Hers was hard evidence. So that's one problem you have with Mike's recounting of this. Who knows where that came from and how it came from? Furthermore, most memories don't reach back below 3 years of age. I mean, if you have a memory back when you're three, it's a snapshot. It generally is not a video. It is something that, in fact, is a piece of a memory. So for him to recall this kind of protracted sort of incident, he woke up, he was walked around, he recalls what the person looked like. I would wonder, and again, I'd love to talk to Mike at great length about this, but I would wonder if, in fact, this was not something that as he got older, that he experienced some things. I don't know whether he saw something, he watched a movie when he was seven, something that got connected to this supposed three-year-old incident when he was half asleep. And any time you're half asleep. I'll share with you something that was fascinating to me. Richard John Newhouse, brilliant, brilliant priest. A rapier-like wit. I think he died very young, 72. He was the editor of First Things, Catholic convert, former Lutheran. He wrote a book. I don't know if it was, maybe it had been an article. I don't recall. But it was called As I Lay Dying. He was in the hospital, and this was not when he died. This was an incident, I think, some years before, that he had a vision. And he reported that a being came to him and essentially said, "It is not your time yet." Now, by all impressions, Newhouse was a pretty faithful, holy guy. And he said, as he recounted this, he said, "I was aware of how easily it would have been to recall this and make a dream real. So he said, I started doing the multiplication tables in my head." And he did a number of other things because he wanted to see if, in fact, he was wide awake. It's the kind of mind this guy had. If he was conscious when this happened to him, because I think he said, "Is it my time?" And he was told, "No, your time is not yet." It's a fascinating recollection. But But I found that fascinating, too, because Newhouse knew how easily it is to confuse some kind of dreamlike experience and make it become reality, especially over time, and especially when you're a little kid. Dr. Ray.
We'll return after these messages.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Of those who do sidewalk counseling or work in pregnancy help centers, people often say that they save babies. I hear this phrase a lot, actually, and it usually bothers me a little bit because it seems to place the children protected by pro-life activism in an isolated chronological category. In this case, the isolated category of cuteness and cuddliness. They are babies, yes, but they are also embryos and adolescents and young adults and old adults. They are human beings. And the best lesson that the pro-life movement can teach to the world is that the human person does not gain his value from whatever stage of development he happens to be in. Why, then, do we place our emphasis on saving babies? Would people lose enthusiasm for pro-life work if instead of claiming to save innocent, beautiful infants, we claimed to save the elderly, the crippled, the destitute? But we do, because they are all contained within the mystery of the unborn child. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Andrew pointed out to me that we had several calls as potential look-back calls, but he said, you're just talking on and on. That is true. Because those calls really spurred a lot of, tangents to go off on, which I thought were fascinating. I've always been intrigued by memory and how it works. On one hand, I'm not sure about some of my memories that I think are so solidly locked in. But on the other hand, I don't know which ones I can be erroneous about. I may think to myself, yeah, that's it. That's exactly what happened. There's an interesting memorial phenomenon, if that's the right way to use memory. I had a friend say to me once, whenever somebody asks you when something happened, and you think it happened X time ago, if you want to be close to when it actually happened, double it. Andrew Krucek, my producer man, and great helpmate on this program, we were talking, and I asked him, this is a few weeks back, I said, Andrew, how long have we been doing E-Person Monday and Look Back Friday? I said, been about 5 years, hasn't it? And he pointed out, no, we have just hit our 10th year anniversary. Now, I never would have thought that. I just figure somebody asked me, I say, oh, yeah, we've been doing this for several years now. It's been 10. So I'm wondering if the natural inability to recall when something was is also a component of this whole memory shift. That it's difficult to, it's almost like a picture that's floating rather than a picture that is a snapshot locked in. It floats. For example, the earliest memory I have as a kid, my dad and my mom were at some car lot trying to start this car. And I'm not going to tell you the year of the car because then you'll do the math and you'll go, holy mackerel, they had cars when this guy was three? And all I remember is my dad trying to start the car, and it wouldn't start. Those older cars, you know. How many times when I had my Cutlass, my 1972 Cutlass, that I drove to work in the morning? Oh, man. I got a 65 Mustang, and it does the same thing. Not like these cars now, man. You touch that thing. That's my earliest memory. It's the last thing I remember, or the first thing I remember in my life. Now, I asked my mom and dad, how, when they were alive, did that happen? They confirmed it. I said, how old was I? And they didn't know. They said, I don't know, Ray. You couldn't have been much more than late twos, maybe. But that's all I remember. And I wonder if my memories of my mom and my dad and the situations we were in, these little snapshots that you have growing up, you could make a photo book out of them. I'm going to be comfortable in saying that's the way it happened because I want those memories. But I have to be realistic and say, well, possibly those are just in my head. Not all of them. Thank you so much for joining me here. Walk with God. Now that's a memory you want to hold on to.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.